Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Thou shalt not judge. For our contemporary culture, especially for the typical university culture, this is perhaps the first and greatest commandment. It may be, in fact, in some places, the only commandment. So the great sin on most university campuses, the great sin of our age, is to be judgmental. And in a certain way, you could say that it's become the capital vice of postmodernity. Now, this poses a challenge to us if we make judgments. If being judgmental is a vice and to be avoided, does it follow that when we make a judgment, we're engaging in an act of vice? That's the question I want to pose, and how to think about whether or not we are being judgmental or doing the right thing in making a judgment. It seems that most people have no trouble accepting that there are scientific truths that we can know as valid in all places at all times. And so when we say, do not judge, most people would agree we're not talking about adopting a perspective of theoretical or universal philosophical skepticism about our mind's capacity to know the truth. So most people will say, oh, well, you know, science does give us some truths, but we're talking about something else when we say don't be judgmental. Okay, that's a good question. What else are we talking about there? So our task in this talk is to address what we mean when we talk about being judgmental and what we mean when we talk about making a judgment. In what sense is being judgmental a vice or a sin? And how is that related to contemporary claims about truth, tolerance, and moral relativism? So that's my agenda. First, to talk about judgment and being judgmental, or making a rash judgment. That's part one of the talk. And then part two of the talk will be about truth, tolerance, and moral relativism, and how that first part fits into the second part. So St. Thomas Aquinas teaches that there are two principal acts of our minds. Now you might say, okay, seems like we just jumped into the deep end here. Trust me, this is not too deep. We're going to get an understanding from this about what our minds are doing when they make a judgment. Okay, so Aquinas, who's following Aristotle, teaches that there are two principal acts of our minds. Now, this is kind of a simplification, but in general. He thinks one act of the mind, the first act, is called simple apprehension. And that's where you grasp what a thing is. It's not super complicated. You encounter Fido and Spot and Rover, and you apprehend that all three of them are dogs. And you abstract the idea or the essence of dog from these particular instances of dogs, or this particular dog, say Fido. Okay, so that's the first act of the mind, simple apprehension. Then you have what the Thomist tradition calls judgment, and this involves joining and separating things. So if you were to write out a sentence, you know that it has a subject and a predicate. And then you can make an affirmative or negative judgment about whether you can say the predicate of the subject, whether the statement is true, that is, whether the statement corresponds to reality. So if you say something like, this dog is angry, it means that you need to know what a dog is, and what being angry is, and that in fact, these are coinciding in this case. More fundamentally, Aquinas would say, you're making a judgment about reality when you say something like, dogs exist and unicorns do not exist, at least so far as we know. I've been told that alligators are in the canal here. I didn't actually see one. I saw what looked like a log. I suspect it was an alligator. I made a judgment not to go swimming in the canal just a minute ago, even though there was a beautiful sunset. I wasn't really seriously tempted. Okay, these kinds of judgments are one of the fundamental aspects of being rational, and therefore of being able to recognize reality around us with our minds. And no science would be possible if we couldn't make these kinds of basic judgments. Okay, so here we're talking about making a judgment in the most fundamental sense. It's really what a rational mind does. It apprehends things and it makes judgments about them. Okay, is this what we're talking about when we're talking about being judgmental? Okay, let's leave that as an open question for a moment. Let's move to another domain, one that's very familiar to us, and that's the law. In the law, you have, for example, a trial. Suppose that a trial was happening down the hall. What would happen in a trial? The goal of a trial is to have findings of fact and conclusions of law. Okay, so the jury might make findings of fact and conclusions of law, and these culminate in what's called a final judgment. That's the result of a trial, a judgment. It's a resolution of the matter as a whole. And that's the order that a judge issues at the end of a trial. He signs his name on the bottom. It's called a judgment. Usually it has that at the top of the page. And then there's an order that issues in response to that judgment. So the law makes judgments. In fact, we could talk about even lawmakers making judgments, and I would contend that you can't make a law without making a judgment. It's part of the process of making a law. It's making a judgment about things in the world. In fact, more than that, it's making a judgment about what is good for our community and what is bad, in order to order the life of the community. So we could use a very neutral sounding example, environmental regulations. We might be tempted to think that they're justified by purely factual or scientific statements, something like high carbon emissions decrease air quality. Okay, sounds like a pretty scientific judgment, right? A scientific statement. My point, though, is that if you look at them carefully, these always carry inside them. They always bear within them a judgment. In this case, it's a judgment that you should not do this kind of thing. You should not have high carbon emissions because they decrease air quality. So judgments like this are implicitly saying a healthy environment is a part of the common good, and the community as a whole should take responsibility for it, and certain actions that harm the environment should not be done, whereas others that are perhaps helpful to the environment should be done. Now, let me ask you, does our culture make moral judgments through the law? Think about the way we talk about intentional polluters. Do we not make a moral judgment about that activity? When I went off to college, this was a long time ago now, I went to college in California, Southern California. I'm from Seattle originally. Seattle now is a very progressive place, but when I was growing up there, California was really the leading edge of environmental laws and things like that. So I had never encountered a recycling bin until I moved to California. We just didn't have recycling where I grew up at home. And after 4 years of going to college, with a trash can and a recycling bin in my dorm room, I just got very used to using the recycling bin, like to drink a soda out of an aluminum can and then, you know, like throw it in the trash can. That's like, what are you doing? You know, there's the recycling bin's right there. Why don't you recycle it? Okay. I then went off to law school on the East Coast, and the California environmental regulations had not made it to my East Coast graduate school. So in the dorms, in fact, in the whole city, there was no recycling program. You couldn't recycle. There was just no way to collect it and get it to the recycling place. I mean, I don't even know if they had recycling depots. But I had a hard time showing up there, throwing these aluminum cans into the trash. Every time I did it, I felt like I was doing something wrong. Now, that's maybe kind of a trivial example, but that sort of thing is real. Our laws begin to train us about the way we ought to behave and instill a kind of moral judgment in our very behavior. So even environmental regulations, I think, are making real judgments. We're starting to make progress on understanding what being judgmental is or is not, I think. This becomes even more clear when you think of the criminal law. Certain actions are not only forbidden, they're punished personally, sometimes quite severely. So, you know, murder or burglary. You might do prison, even something worse than that in some states. And notice that these punishments are not only to deter future wrongdoing, but also to punish. That is the purpose of the criminal law, actually, to punish. So even if we were to find a 90-year-old murderer who had gotten away with his crime many years before, now we know he's not even physically capable of committing the crime again, the law will try him because it thinks that we should have a judgment of this person's actions. So what I'm building up to is saying that these judgments begin as judgments about things in the world, but actually it turns out that judgments about things in the world always involve also a moral dimension. And legal judgments always also involve a moral dimension. In fact, judgments which are necessary for any kind of rational activity always have some kind of moral dimension. And moral judgments are really judgments about things in the world. So, in fact, it is almost impossible to refrain from making judgments. You must make judgments. So this leads us to a capital point that Aquinas, I think, teaches very clearly. There is not a radical difference between the kind of act that our mind makes when we judge that something exists or is the case, and when we judge that something is good and ought to be done, say good for the thing we encounter. So, Goldie the goldfish. Goldie the goldfish exists, is alive. We see her. We see her in her fish tank. We make a judgment there, a judgment that she exists. And then we can say, don't take Goldie out of her tank. It's bad for her. And it's really bad if you flush her down the toilet, right? I'm sorry if I'm aggressing you with that example. There were no trigger warnings before this lecture. Both of these judgments are judgments about reality. Our mind is grasping something true about the world around us, and we're seeing what is good about that reality. So my claim is that it's normal and inevitable that we will judge some things to be good and other things to be bad, that it's a part of the structure of the human mind as it has access to reality, and that this is fundamentally what a moral judgment is. It's a judgment about what is good and should be done, and what is evil and should not be done. Okay, is that the same as being judgmental? Can we distinguish these things? And although Thomas Aquinas does not use terminology like judgmental, There is something that is analogous in his thinking that I think can help us to understand what's wrong with being judgmental and how that's different from just making a judgment. So I don't think Thomas Aquinas needs any great introduction to you. He was a medieval Dominican. I like to take credit for being one of his disciples and having received the same habit that he wore. He develops a sophisticated account of a vice that, with some caveats, we could identify as being judgmental. He calls this the vice of rash judgment. So Aquinas teaches that as human beings, we can only judge what we see. So, for example, in the actions of our neighbors, what are we able to see? We're only able to see their exterior act. And that act might be wrong, it might be a sin. What can we not see? We cannot see, he says, the interior movements of the heart of our neighbor. So this is a quote from Aquinas. He quotes 1 Kings 16. Man sees what appears, but the Lord beholds the heart. And then Aquinas continues after the scripture quote. For to God alone is reserved the judgment of hidden things, among which especially are counted the thoughts of the heart. And hence, if anyone would presume to judge of these things, it is a rash judgment. That's the end of the quotation. So Aquinas cautions us that instead of judging our neighbor's intentions harshly, we should presume the best of our neighbor. In fact, we're supposed to love our neighbors. We should desire our neighbor's good, and ultimately, our neighbor's repentance and salvation. So there are two important Thomistic distinctions about making judgments. The first distinction: when we speak the truth about sinful actions, and yes, sometimes we do have to speak about sinful actions, we should make sure that we're primarily judging actions, which we can judge, observe, assess, and not judging persons, because to judge a person implies making a judgment about the interior movements of the heart. And that's God's domain. It's not our domain, at least insofar as we're private persons. Now, maybe we could talk about how this works if you want to ask questions about how this works in a criminal case, for example, where you do have to make some kind of judgment with respect to the person. But as private individuals, we can judge acts. We don't judge the persons. And Aquinas thinks that if we presume to judge the movements of the heart without sufficient reason, now we might be able to draw some inferences about the movements of someone's heart from their external actions, but in general, we should refrain from making those judgments about interior movements of the heart, and to do so is typically the sin of rash judgment. That's interesting. Okay, the second distinction is closely related to this first one. It's a distinction between, on the one hand, the objective goodness or evil of the action. You might say it's objective rightness or wrongness. And then, on the other hand, the subjective moral culpability of the person who does it, the actor. This is actually an extremely important distinction that it's very helpful for all of us to know. It's especially helpful if you're in a position of responsibility. It's helpful if you're a Catholic priest and you have to hear confessions. This actually does come up in the confessional, trying to understand, like, maybe my own culpability, people coming to grips with their own culpability. Okay, so it's a distinction between being able to identify the act as wrong, but the person may not have any subjective culpability or kind of moral, it may not have engaged in an act of interior moral wrongdoing. Okay, how there may be no moral fault on the part of the actor. That's what I'm trying to say. There's an amusing story that illustrates this point, I think, very well, written by the novelist Douglas Adams. Does anybody know that novelist? He's a humor novelist. He wrote The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I can't really recommend his books. They're actually very skeptical, kind of atheistic books. But he's a funny writer. And I came across this anecdote, which he represents as a true story about himself. So I thought it illustrates this point perfectly. So he was supposed to be traveling somewhere in England. And he was taking the train. He made a mistake about what time his train was departing. So he was at the train station with some time to kill. So to pass the time, he bought a newspaper, a cup of coffee, and a packet of cookies. And he sat down at a table. So this is just a quotation from a long account of this episode that he himself wrote. So he writes, "I want you to picture the scene. Here's the table, the newspaper, the cup of coffee, the packet of cookies. There's a guy sitting opposite me, perfectly ordinary looking guy, wearing a business suit, carrying a briefcase. It didn't look like he was going to do anything weird. What he did was this. He suddenly leaned across, picked up the packet of cookies, tore it open, took one out, and ate it. I did what any red-blooded Englishman would do. I ignored it. I stared at the newspaper. I took a sip of coffee, and I thought, what am I going to do? In the end, I thought, nothing for it, I'll just have to go for it. And I tried very hard not to notice that the packet of cookies was already mysteriously opened. I took a cookie out for myself, and I thought, that settled him. But it hadn't, because a moment or two later, he did it again. He took another cookie. And we went through the whole packet like this. He took one, I took one. He took one, I took one. Finally, when we got to the end, he stood up and walked away. Well, we exchanged meaningful looks, and then he walked away. And I breathed a sigh of relief and sat back. A moment or two later, the train was coming in, so I tossed back the rest of my coffee, stood up, picked up my newspaper, and underneath it were my packet of cookies. So, okay, end of quotation. All right, what's your moral assessment of what Adams did? Objectively, he stole the other guy's cookies. And, you know, depending on the people you live with, that can be a very grave sin. What was the other man thinking of Adams as he was doing this? He was thinking, this is completely outrageous. This guy is just brazenly eating my cookies. But Adams, was Adams guilty of theft? So he took someone else's property. He destroyed it, right? Openly and notoriously. But I think we would say he wasn't guilty of theft because he didn't know that he was stealing the other guy's cookies. He thought he was eating his own cookies. So in justice, we could say Adams owes this other guy half a packet of cookies. So there's an objective wrong. Adams caused it. He really does owe the guy the cookies. But he subjectively is not guilty of wronging the other man. Does that make sense? Now, it's important to realize that these two things are happening at the same time. There is an objective evil, the destruction of the cookies or the theft of the cookies. There is a subjective error by Adams. So he was just mistaken. The objective evil is not erased by the subjective error. So there still is a wrong done in some sense, but that's in the objective order. With respect to the subjective culpability of Adams, he was not committing a moral fault because of ignorance. That's one of the classic categories by which we say someone's act is not imputed to him. So ignorance of the fact, like he was ignorant of the fact that these were not his cookies. Sometimes ignorance of the law will excuse an action. There can be other reasons that one is not morally culpable in a classic tradition that Aquinas talks about. He speaks about these things as undermining the voluntariness of the act. So what makes an act morally evil from a movement of your heart is when you set your heart on something that you know is wrong. And when you don't have that capacity to set your heart in that way, your will, when your will is not disordered in that way, the external act may still be wrong, may still be gravely injurious, in fact, but it may not be morally culpable. That's the issue. Now, classically, the Catholic tradition would say that everyone is held to at least know the Ten Commandments. So you can't not know that those things are wrong. But you may be ignorant of, say, the recycling rules in a particular community if you've not visited it before. That would be a rather different situation. Okay, that's part one of my talk. I just wanted to kind of get to that point to say there are objective wrongs. We never want, by talking about the subjective reasons why somebody may not be morally culpable, to deny that there was an objective wrong. But at the same time, just to say there's an objective wrong does not mean automatically in every case that there is also subjective culpability. These are two different kinds of judgments. And Aquinas says, especially, we are capable of judging the one and we have difficulty judging the other from the outside. So we should be cautious about doing the judgment about the movements of the heart without sufficient grounding. And when we make those judgments, we're making rash judgments. And you now might be asking yourself, if it'd be a good thing to ask yourself, to do a little examination of conscience. How often, when I am angry at someone else, or frustrated, or complaining, or grumbling about someone else, am I actually making a judgment about their interior intentions? And I think often we find that we very frequently jump to conclusions about what someone was intending to do. And that's not good, and we should try to resist that because it's a rash judgment. Okay, now part two of my talk. So we've drawn some distinctions from Aquinas that help us understand making judgments. But now I want to address really what's more at issue when we hear people in the contemporary context say, you shouldn't be judgmental. Because, yes, a part of it is you shouldn't make rash judgments about someone's interior movements of the heart. And that's true. But sometimes when they say you shouldn't be judgmental, they mean something more than that. So let's talk for a bit about relativism, because I think this is often at the root of these kinds of claims that you shouldn't make judgments, or that judgments somehow are morally illegitimate. And okay, so I'm going to try to categorize some different versions of relativism that you encounter today, and then basic problems that they face. So relativism comes in several different varieties. I think they can all be found in our contemporary culture. They certainly can be found on most contemporary college campuses. The first is cultural relativism. So according to a standard form of cultural relativism, right and wrong depend on what the dominant culture says, or on what you were conditioned to believe by social, religious, cultural forces. And it's basically saying there's no absolute standard of right and wrong that transcends your culture. Your judgments about right and wrong are culturally dependent. So change the culture, you change the judgments. And they then are going to say, yeah, don't judge another culture, right? Okay, historical relativism. This generally argues that right and wrong depends on the mores, the moral sentiments, you might say, of a certain historical period. So what people thought was right in the 18th century, we now see is wrong in the 21st century. So just over 150 years ago, slavery was legal in the United States. It was even praised by some as a positive good. Today, thank God, you can hardly find anyone who would deny that slavery is morally wrong. So you trot out a fact like this and you say, well, obviously this shows that there are no claims to moral rightness or wrongness that transcend a given historical period, because moral judgments change over time. Okay, third type of relativism that you find today. This goes by the technical name of legal positivism. You find this in law schools. I was myself a lawyer, so I encountered this and thought about it a fair amount. Legal positivism holds that right and wrong depends on what the positive law says. And that's all. There's nothing beyond that. When the law makes a judgment, then it sort of determines the question. So if the Supreme Court says that there is a right to do X, then doing X is morally acceptable. And I think that's actually a rather common view in our own culture. Americans tend to be, I mean, despite all the things that we might say or that others might say about us, Americans tend to be pretty focused on the law. Like, we do really care about what the law says, and we tend to think that the law shapes our own personal moral judgments. Okay, all three of these forms of relativism, cultural, historical relativism, legal positivism, all of them assert that there is no unchanging, non-arbitrary standard of right and wrong. They claim that all moral claims are relative to culture, historical context, or we could add more, language, legal regime, religious tradition, and so forth. Okay, what kind of answer can we make to these claims of moral relativism? So let me give you four quick replies. The first reply: the fatal flaw of all forms of relativism is that they contain an internal contradiction. Philosophers refer to this as the self-reference test, right? So they fail to be true when they refer back to themselves. So all forms of relativism assert that the proposition, there are no truths that hold always and everywhere, is a truth that holds always and everywhere. Do you see the difficulty? So the relativist says, there are no truths that hold always and everywhere, except for one, that's the truth that there are no truths that hold always and everywhere. So it's internally incoherent, it's self-contradictory. Okay, second problem. I mean, this is just super quick philosophical overview. Second reply to relativism: while there might be some superficial evidence that seems to support cultural and historical relativism, for example, like the example of slavery that I was just talking about, or disagreements across cultures about some particular moral questions, the relativist argument ignores the much broader and deeper agreement about moral principles. So often, if there's a disagreement on one issue, there's actually agreement on the vast majority of moral questions, and only occasionally do you find aberrations. And then really what we should be doing is identifying, yeah, okay, it's possible for human beings to go wrong and to make bad judgments. Sometimes a particular historical period or a culture makes a bad judgment. That doesn't mean that every moral judgment is invalid or relative. It just means that sometimes there are bad judgments and we can call them out. In fact, this is part of our culture. Think of, for example, the Civil Rights Movement. The Civil Rights Movement in the United States, think of Martin Luther King. He is able to stand within his tradition, our American civil rights tradition, and critique it from within and say, you are not living up to your own standards by engaging in, say, Jim Crow laws, segregation laws. By making that argument, that argument should be impossible to make if you really are a relativist, because you're moral judgments should be conditioned by your historical culture. But it's certainly possible for someone to stand within your moral culture and your historical time and make a critique of it. And that suggests that you can make a judgment that is not culturally conditioned or historically conditioned. And we see that happening all the time. Okay, third reply. Why should the fact that some people and even some cultures have made excuses for terrible things, grave moral wrongs, lead us then to conclude that there are no such things as grave moral wrongs? That just doesn't seem to follow. And also, we should not confuse the moral status of social or cultural conventions, like burping at the table, with deeper moral principles, like intentionally killing an innocent person is wrong. So there's certainly a lot of variation about table manners or social interactions. But to think that intentionally killing an innocent person is acceptable, that is quite universally condemned. So the relativist argument deliberately obscures these distinctions, claiming that because some moral censures are merely because of convention, some judgments that something is wrong is just because of, like, polite society's conventions, therefore there are no deeper principles. But that does not follow. Okay, fourth point. The relativist needs to be able to claim that not only is one sometimes determined by your historical period or culture, but that you are always determined by your historical or cultural context. And that seems to be plainly false. Martin Luther King would be a good example. Okay, there are other theoretical arguments about moral relativism that we could add, but I'd like to make just one final fifth point, which is that in practice, I don't think there are any true moral relativists. Because even moral relativism itself is making a moral judgment, which it tries very hard to camouflage as something else, about all those judgmental people out there who believe in absolute moral truths. This, in fact, is a judgment. And is it not true that our age, which claims to tell us that being judgmental is the worst thing you can be, turns out to be extremely judgmental if you make the wrong kinds of assessments about reality? So this is totally unsurprising if you're a student of Thomas Aquinas. Because, to go back to the first point, the point that we began this talk with, according to St. Thomas, moral judgments are just judgments about reality and what is good. And in fact, Aquinas thinks there is an unbreakable metaphysical link between being and goodness. So this is the most philosophically fundamental part of this talk. Insofar as something exists, it is good. To be is good. And for Aquinas, the very structure of our desiring and of our action necessarily implies that we desire and try to obtain what we judge to be good for us. And ultimately, these desires, these longings, these thirsts, they are emerging from and anchored in the kind of beings that we are. Now, it's certainly true we can have disordered desires, and we can make mistakes about judging what will be really good for me. Our own sins compound the problem because they make our disordered desires worse, harder to control. But even with all of that, there is a fundamental orientation of every person to reach out for what that person perceives to be good. And that's what we are all doing all the time. And that is what a moral judgment is. It's a judgment that X is good, good for me, good for my neighbor, good for my community, and hence is to be sought. And Y, on the other hand, is bad and to be avoided. So the deepest and most metaphysical explanation of the problem with moral relativism is that everyone always orients themselves to something they think is good. It may not really be good for them, but at least they think it's good for them. And we find that in actual practice, they will inevitably make claims on others, even demands, with respect to that good. So, notwithstanding our own culture's claim that they have a kind of non-judgmental relativism, we find, in fact, in our time, all kinds of judgments being made about what is good. And these are not only factual or scientific or pragmatic judgments, but moral judgments. And so, in fact, in the end, there are no moral relativists, because it's metaphysically impossible to actually escape making judgments and trying to impose them on others, at least in the sense of trying to communicate them to others and bring others to act according to them. So my concluding point, there might be some theoretical relativists out there, but there are no practical moral relativists. We're inevitably making judgments all the time, and we do this based on principles that transcend culture and history, and those include moral judgments. The only question, really, is whether we're going to camouflage those judgments in the rhetoric of being non-judgmental or of relativism, or whether we can bring them out into the open where we can rationally debate them and assess them. And actually, that's what politics, in the best sense of the word, is really supposed to be doing. It's supposed to be about trying to judge what is good for our community and to make that judgment in common with each other. So being able to see that making judgments is a good thing and it's fundamental to living a rational life, this is good not only for us as persons, but also for us as a human community. If we don't acknowledge that there is a truth out there that can be known, then we have very serious disorders, disorders in our own lives, but also disorders in our common life. And this is what I want to end with. It's a beautiful quotation, one that I think is very powerful, from Pope St. John Paul II. Writing in his encyclical Veritatis Splendor, on the crisis of truth in the modern world, you can hear St. John Paul drawing on his personal experience of totalitarianism. Because as you probably know, he lived both under the Nazi regime and under a Soviet communist regime. And that experience taught him that relativism comes with a monstrous human cost. So this is a quote from John Paul II in Veritatis Splendor. He writes, "Totalitarianism arises out of a denial of truth in the objective sense. If there is no transcendent truth, in obedience to which man achieves his full identity, then there is no sure principle for guaranteeing just relations between people. Their self-interest as a class, group, or nation would inevitably set them in opposition to one another." So now listen to what he says here. "If one does not acknowledge transcendent truth, then the force of power takes over, and each person tends to make full use of the means at his disposal to impose his own interests or his own opinions with no regard for the rights of others." End quote. John Paul II is trying to say that if we don't govern our relations with each other by the truth apprehended by reason, by the mind, which allows us to discuss together what is right, what is wrong, what is good, what should be done. If we don't govern ourselves in that way, then we revert to the exercise of power, where we do not try to persuade other people that this is good or right, and we just try to dominate them and make them do what we want. The view that it is not possible to have a conversation about what is right and wrong, because those are always culturally conditioned judgments, that view leads to the practical political consequence that we are just going to organize ourselves to control other people and enforce what we want or what we think is good. This is a classic Marxist approach. It's also what a lot of critical theories are doing, whether it's critical race theory or critical gender theory. It's trying to say, basically, we are going to use whatever means are available at our disposal to obtain the result that we think is right without trying to engage in a process of actual common deliberation about what is really morally right or wrong. I think John Paul's insight that a crisis of truth leads to a crisis of democracy and also of freedom is prophetic, because in the absence of some objective truth, you can't appeal to any argument or reason, but only to power. And that's what Benedict XVI later called the dictatorship of relativism. So in the end, a relativist view will force you into a dynamic where reason does not have a place. And without rational discourse, there can only be appeals to ideology or to group identity or to political power, rather than appeals to truth. There will still be moral judgments there. That's part of what I'm trying to say. But they will be judgments not made subject to a kind of open, reasoned analysis, but rather imposed by acts of will or of power. That's inimical to our rational nature. It's also inimical to the nature of the contemporary university, which does not exist to serve political ideology or power, but for the sake of pursuing knowledge, knowledge of the truth, because the human mind is made for the truth. And from the truth, freedom springs. As you all know, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.